All right, folks, hello and welcome to Lecture 47 in this American History program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. Today's topic is the Colonial Wars and their aftermath. So we are working on building a bridge between our understanding of the early colonial period with the successful settlement of Jamestown and then Plymouth, and then the gradual expansion of the colonies with the addition of Maryland and Rhode Island and the conquest of New Netherlands that makes New York and so on. We definitely went through that succession of colonies quite rapidly. And we're also going to be going through a succession of colonial wars quite rapidly. And that is by design. That is on purpose. What we are trying to do is we are trying to study this sum that is American history in the manner that most profitably helps us to understand the world around us. So, in the past, you know, I have spent quite a lot of time on separate colonies. I would spend a bunch of time on Pennsylvania. I'd spend a bunch of time on this and that, and more detail, and it's been more time talking about what was going on in Europe at the same time, and so on, and it was just too much, basically. So what I'm trying to do now is to be more selective and almost ruthlessly selective, and saying, well, I'm not pretending that things didn't happen during these times, but they just don't have, and I'm going to use a big, big, big wordy phrase here for you guys, which, you know, if you like it or not, I'm not sure, but the big wordy phrase I'm going to use is, they just don't have enough present-centric value significance. So let me put that down. Why not? I think that's a good phrase. Two interesting hyphenated concepts. So present-centric meaning, right? Having to do with the world we live in. We study history using our minds now, here. This is where we live. This is where we pursue our values, the present. So what we are interested in about the past, which is a 5,000-year ocean of data from which we can mine whatever we want, but if we want to do it well, if we don't want to go and drown in that ocean of information, we have to have a method that allows us to focus on it and to be selective in our treatment of it so that what comes out of it is an awareness that's actually helpful. Or what the Founding Fathers would call useful knowledge. Right? Power, or what Francis Bacon called powerful knowledge. That was a concept of the Renaissance and of the Founding Fathers. So that's what Thomas Jefferson said about history, in fact. He said it is that knowledge most useful to us. But he was speaking of a very, very selective reading of the past. He really would say, European history, throw the whole thing out. And he would just say, Rome and Greece, that's all we need to look at. He was very, very selective, and rightly so. They had a very special problem to solve, the founders at the time. I feel much the same way, that we have to be very selective. And so it's not to say that there weren't a lot of nice people living in South Carolina in 1700 and doing some interesting farming work and whatnot. And not to say that there wasn't this or that happening in New Hampshire or some other place. I mean, it's a part of the story, right? But the present-centric value significance of what was being done there is much lower than that of other information that we need to focus on. So it just does not have enough to do with our values for us to spend too much time there. So in that way, we are flying through, in a way, almost. You might have this feeling of, wow, we've gone quite quickly through quite a stream of data here from from our anger facts of 1607, 1620, right through to this colonial period here, and we're gonna leap through it in a way, and part of the leap that we're going to undertake has to do with this succession of wars, right? So in terms of kind of the timeline of colonies that we've seen, right? We have our anchor colonies, Jamestown in 1607 and Plymouth in 1620. That's when successful English colonization really gets underway. So that we absolutely need to focus on. Now, whether or not we're going to decide any other anchors are necessary, you know, we can just for the moment kind of remind ourselves there. That, well, Maryland, for instance, is a good one, is 1634, right? And then Rhode Island, because of Roger Williams and religious freedom, I think is a significant one. Present-centric, significant, 1636. And then we have the conquest of New York from the Netherlands, you might remember, in 1664. So this is quite a hop and a skip here, right, through this period. And then it gets us to here. So I don't want you to have a sense of there being this huge gap between your awareness of early colonization and the American Revolution, because we are leaping through it. But I want you to see what's there, but also realize that we are not focusing on it with great deliberation because it doesn't have that degree of present-centric value significance. Now, let me just put it even a little bit more precisely. It doesn't have that present-centric value significance in our context. Now, when I say that, you know, actually, I should be spending more time maybe asking you if you understand and asking you to restate this in your own words. What do you suppose I mean by that? When I say studying too much of the colonial period is not good in our context. What do you suppose I mean? As opposed to, for instance, you know, a graduate school history context, which would be hugely different, right? So no, your context, your learning context is what? Keen?
Well, number one, the most simple thing is that we don't live in colonial times. We live in 2015, and so it wouldn't be too helpful for us to study, as far as present-centric awareness, to study that in the colonial period too specifically. But moreover, we're not, you know, you're talking about graduate school, you know, this is we need to get the basics of history down, the really important stuff, before we go into the details. Otherwise, the details can't really help us.
Oh, well put, right? So you need to get the basics, you need to get a foundation of knowledge before the details will be meaningful for you. Right? So imagine if, I mean, this is these facts here are facts that I have absolutely memorized. But they make sense in my context, because I'm a history teacher, I'm a historian. If I don't know these things, then I have some serious gaps that are not worthy of me in my context and my position. I need to remember King William's War. And I can tell you a lot about it, which is why, I mean, it's connected to a context for me. But for you right now, if I tell you memorize King William's War, what for? You wouldn't be able to, your context of knowledge in your context of life, basically, doesn't make sense for me to tell you to do that. This is completely downright wrong. And this is just what is just staggering about education today. It's just staggering, and it's really sad, and I'm hoping that I can start to make a case to more and more people about how history should be taught, because if you look at the way that history is taught nowadays, it's the exact opposite. It's a disaster. Because not only would you be told for a high school test to memorize these things, you would be told to memorize 10 times more stuff and answer multiple choice, useless multiple choice questions. And then, you know, and I know, what happens after you've taken the test? The corruption here, the pedagogical corruption is unspeakable. What happens after you take the test is you forget everything. And you are never asked to recall any of it. And you are never asked to actually build a tower of knowledge. So educators today should be ashamed of what they are doing. And this is just, we live in a time where the education is just awful. And this memorization, short-range memorization of a vast, just a huge amount of facts for no purpose. It's really, it's despicable. Because the writing for a test is not a legitimate human purpose. You're supposed to be gaining knowledge in order to help you live. In order to be an independent human being on this earth. Not to jump through somebody's hoops. It's really, really awful. So I'm not going to ask you to memorize these things. I want you to be aware of them, and I want you to understand also as we go along here how it is that we proceed. Why do we focus on some things and not others? And I want you to know that I'm thinking of these things on your behalf. And this is on purpose. So, and with regard to, for instance, these three wars, the first three colonial wars, King William's War, as it was known in America, because at the time the King of England was William, and then Queen Anne's War, and then King George's War. They were known according by the king who was in charge at the time. What happened in each one of these wars was a bunch of fighting, people died, and then things went back to... Who can tell me what that means? The status quo ante bellum. Any ideas? Ben, go ahead.
The way it was before the war.
The way it was before the war. Right, exactly. So, status quo, the way things are. And ante, before the war. So these are peculiar as episodes in history because... this is why they don't really have present-centric value significance in our context. Because we're not interested in things that didn't actually affect history. Things that didn't actually have any interesting results. It's not that we're saying that the people who died in those wars were not nice people or bad people or whatever, right? It's not good or bad that we're talking about. We're talking about significant in our context. And not everybody is. And so these wars, we're going to know that they happened. I'm telling you that they happened. But I'm also telling you that the whole sum of their significance to us is simply this. And that what we really need to focus on is this one. And even only so much, because there's not that much to say about it. This is the one. This is the French and Indian War, as it is known, is the decisive conflict. And that there is a good criterion for deciding on what you want to study in history. Look for things that are decisive. There's a history book called The 15 Most Decisive Battles in the History of the World. That's a great book. Because the author is thinking properly, he's saying, which ones mattered? Which ones changed the world? And so that's the same thing here. As far as American history is concerned, these first three are not decisive battles. They're really just footnotes in our context. It's the French and Indian War that is a decisive battle. It is a transformative event. And the transformation is evident right here on our map. Right? It is the difference between what you see at the top and what you see in the bottom frame. Which is big. It's colors are colors and maps are maps. It doesn't always tell you the substance of things. Right? You have to be careful about interpreting what a map looks like and what you think that a color means. Right? Cause it's not a uniform thing. You gotta have an oversimplified awareness of what you're looking at here, right? But it is a decisive war because Britain is going to take over North America. So what else do we need to know about it other than that? Well, one thing that we that is interesting to know about it is that, well, this Ohio company here that was created by the Virginians was kind of an important actor in bringing about the conflict. And when we're talking about the Ohio Company, we're talking about Thomas Jefferson's father. We're talking about this generation that immediately precedes the American Revolution. Talking about some interesting folks. And when they start to have problems with the French, who have been working their way down these rivers and up these rivers and down the Ohio all the way to Louisiana, and we're starting to talk about that conflict with them, well, we're going to start to see some other folks, and especially George Washington. So that's cool. I mean, that has an element of present-centrism to it, right? Because George Washington is the founding father. He is the first president. He earned that presidency unanimously among the founding fathers, and because he was General George Washington in the American Revolution and responsible for the military success of Americans in gaining their independence. So it's whenever you've got a character like that, it's interesting to see him and learn more about him. That becomes something that's worth doing. And so, in fact, what we see is that George Washington's military career starts to, he starts to become an important figure in the French and Indian War. So that's kind of an interesting relevancy here to his story in life. If we look down here in these two, these red arrows, which indicate the movement of armies or forces during the French and Indian War, we see 1754 Washington. So this was his command. As a major, he was given command of an expedition into that contested territory. His force was too small, and so he was forced to surrender. And he was allowed to return to Virginia, and then he returned under the command of General Braddock in 1755 as one of Braddock's officers. Now, again, that's still just kind of a whole bunch of who, what, when's, so not that big of a deal. But there is an interesting story about the French and Indian Wars, which has to do, it's going to impact Washington as a military commander. It's going to impact him as a military thinker and contribute to him being a good leader when it comes time to command the Americans in the Revolution. And that is that in European warfare, the way that Europeans fought their wars back in Europe was, it was kind of a game. It was pretend. It was, in a way, it was pretend war. Pretend civilized war. The lords and kings would be in command. They'd be on horseback, and they would be kind of engaging in a war game, and they would move pieces on the board like a chess game, and meanwhile, regular people died, right? They would be moving around as the foot soldiers and the infantrymen and so on, and they would die, and there was a kind of, there was a rule book and a set of procedures in fighting wars. It was very artificial, and it was very formal, like a kind of a game, because the lords and the kings viewed their own lives as being superior, right? They viewed themselves as being better than everybody else. And therefore, whenever they fought each other, it was the lords and kings on one side versus the lords and kings on another side. They had a kind of set of formal rules that say, we don't hurt each other because we're the better ones. Which is really despicable. They're commanding the common man to go die for their cause, but in the meantime, they won't even attack each other, and the lords and so on kind of would play by a certain rule book, which was, you know, the pawns move first, right? Kill the commoners. They don't matter. And maybe we can sort out this disagreement between us just with dead commoners. And we, the commanders, we matter more. And so they had this artificial way of fighting wars. And the commanders were kind of off limits. Now, I tell you this story because what happened in the French and Indian Wars was instructive in that regard, because the English had more forces. They tended to have more colonies. The colonies were way larger than New France in terms of population. The English had more forces, so in other words, just more of everything, basically, than the French. And so the French and their Indian allies adopted a tactic which was considered ungentlemanly, which was considered kind of uncivilized. And the tactic was the exact opposite of European war. This is the tactic. This is a pretty cool painting. I mean, it's not what I would call it's a great work of art. The scheme, the theme is too delimited. But it's kind of a cool painting because it depicts this tactic. It depicts a tactic which came to be known as guerrilla tactics. And that's a homonym for a word, so you might mistakenly assume that it's one word when it's not. Guerrilla is actually a Spanish word, guerrilla, which means little war. So little war tactics means very different than the typical European warfare. What are they doing here is the exact opposite. They're all hiding. They're not out on the open battlefield. They're hiding behind trees. They're hiding behind rocks. They're being very surreptitious and in a sense, dishonorable. But the whole purpose here is to win against a superior force by killing the commander. The opposite of European war. Right? Because when you kill the commander, you create disarray in the opposing army. And you also totally, I mean, what else happens if you adopt a policy of killing commanders? That creates kind of a really interesting dynamic in the war. What starts to happen? Thoughts about that, Alexander?
Nobody wants to be the commander.
Yeah, this is now the psychology of war changes. Your whole perspective on, you used to be the commander. That means you were safe. You knew that. Everybody would follow the rules. You wouldn't get killed. But in these engagements, under Braddock especially, and this is the death of Braddock here, basically, and that's George Washington next to him with the black hat. He's the commander gets killed first. And that's kind of interesting, as an idea, because you have to take responsibility for being a leader of men and for, you know, wreaking this havoc, I think is the right word, on your fellow human beings. And it's really interesting. I don't know. This is kind of a little bit of an aside. Maybe I won't bother. Never mind. I don't want to get off on too much of a tangent. So in this story, we have the wounding and death of General Braddock, and we have George Washington stepping up and taking command and learning this tactical lesson that war in America is not necessarily like European war. The rules that you think apply to war, we call those the rules of engagement. They don't necessarily work this way, right? You have to be ready to see that war is mass murder, and the idea that it would be conducted according to so-called civilized rules is actually folly. If you take up the proper perspective on war, and so it's, I mean, it's Never mind, I'm getting into too much philosophy of war here. We'll talk more about that in the Civil War, too. It's kind of really interesting. So Washington is experiencing this, and it's really shaping him as a commander. And the truth is, though, that the war was won in a European fashion. Ultimately, going back to our map, where is it? Ultimately, what had to happen was Quebec had to be conquered. So you can see it on this map here. You can see this red arrow of a naval fleet departing from the British colonies, going up, destroying this fort at Louisbourg, and then sailing in 1759 under General Wolfe to Quebec. And this is going to be... This is a huge battle, one of the most important battles in the history of Canada, because basically the English defeated the French. And this has a big, big significance for the whole identity of Canada and the whole identity of Quebec as a part of Canada. And it has a broader significance in terms of just the British control of North America for us. And so, going back to this one here, this is kind of a cool painting that depicts the death of the British general, General Wolfe, during this battle. It was a hugely significant battle because, well, the consequence of defeating Britain, defeating France, was simple to capture, right, in terms of, it's right here, right? Once again, going back to this. And when I go back and I look at history and think about the way that the world has been shaped, and I think about and I wonder about the prospects of civilization and so on, and the way that the world is, it's interesting to me that it's about this time, for the first time ever in the history of mankind, that the world starts to have a center. I think that's a neat fact. I think that's a potentially very important identification. That, in other words, the world didn't have a center for what amounts to about 4,800 years out of 5,000. The world was a clutch of archaic, isolated cultures at a very low plateau of development, at a very basic level of development for as far as human life is concerned. It's kind of shocking to think about how long it has taken us as human beings to grow and become what we are now, and to have this globalized civilization. And it's only at about this point, at about 1763, that the world starts to have a center. It's true that there were empires like Spain and Portugal and Netherlands and so on, but they were, again, all very separate and all very kind of loosely connected. And it's only starting in 1763 that Britain starts to be the country that's going to be at the center of it all. Before the world was America-centric, it was Anglo-centric. Before America, the only great globally significant superpower in the history of the world was the British Empire. So it's kind of cool that this is happening right at this point. It's just another feature of kind of life now. We've talked about globalization and America-centrism. It's a stage in the way that history has gone. And the first great center of the world was England, was Britain. So that's kind of a neat fact. Keen, go ahead.
You say that it's the first global power just because, like, you know, in the center of the world, only because Greece and Rome weren't truly global, so they had to start America.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Greece, first of all, the Athenian Empire was minute. It was just the, it was just Eastern. I mean, yes, Alexander the Great was, I don't consider him to be really Greek. So, but the Athenian Empire was really minute. The Roman Empire was not a global empire. Yeah. And the Americas were completely isolated from the rest of the world. So they were major powers. That was kind of, there were isolated major powers. And China, it was, for instance, you know, it was the Middle Kingdom, the Chinese call it, but only of a small constellation of cultures. So yeah, there was nothing global. Nothing. And since 1763, this war, this French and Indian War, was actually part of a worldwide war. And so what we see over here, for instance, which is very significant, present-centric significance is quite high. The British are starting to conquer India. And so it's just the beginning, and it's going to take them time, and it's going to grow over time. They're going to keep on expanding it. They're going to expand to Australia and New Zealand as well. And evidently they're going to lose the U.S., but expand into Canada and then into Africa as well. So the British Empire is just going to eventually become the largest empire in the history of the world. So it starts back here in 1763. And, well, the thing is, this word empire should have some significance, right, to you. It should be kind of like a trigger word that should kind of have some, you know, thoughts associated with it. And because an empire is a certain kind of country slash, you know, it's not just a country. Right? It's a certain kind of collection of territories under a ruler. It definitely involves the premise of conquest and power. And this is what's going to lead to the American Revolution. Because as this British Empire is forming, and as the ambition of the British king becomes global, he's thinking of the world in the palm of his hand. He's thinking of how he's going to be the greatest king ever. And, well, that is a corrupt thought process, right? It's a process of thinking in terms of power over other human beings. And it starts to become obvious to the colonists that they are being viewed in a certain way. Now, what was always there, as it was always there in the sense that, remember, that a colony was something that was supposed to be under the control of the home country. So they're supposed to be thinking of themselves as Englishmen. And they did. Right? But in a way, they continued to think of themselves as Englishmen because they were so separate and so free, so far apart from the king and his power, and living a life that people in Europe could not have imagined in terms of their separation from the power of the king. So there's kind of conditions were such that Americans were especially free at a time, and it had been free for so long, at a time when the king now was starting to get it in his mind that he's going to rule the world. And that he wants real control over the colonists. So it's kind of a perfect storm. It was just the right set of ingredients for the Americans to rebel against the king. But what we haven't yet got in our story is the ingredients of a revolution. Rebellion and revolution are not the same thing. The American Revolution is what changed the world. And what I mean by that is, well, a rebellion is just you don't like the king and you have some, you know, really powerful grievance against him, so you rebel. But in the absence of any other ideas, which is what you see everywhere, China, India, the Middle East, Europe, every other culture in the world? In the absence of any other idea, once you're done in your rebellion, what's the outcome? What do you... Well, this comes back to this, right? What happens when a Chinese emperor is overthrown? What happens when an Egyptian pharaoh is overthrown? What happens when a Mesopotamian king is overthrown? Keen?
There's a new person or group of people in charge, and they're different people, but if the idea has kind of changed, then it's the same sort of minute.
It's the same, exactly. Go back to exactly the same situation, having a king again. It might be a different group of people. It might be just a different member of the same family. It might, you know, the modifications to the way that life is are temporary and really non-essential. Right? Life doesn't change. It's just, you're just changing the cast of characters. And pretty soon it goes back to the same situation and you're back at it again. And so, yeah, what we haven't yet got is an understanding of, or of, why it would be that the English colonists in America would not just rebel. We'll see the reasons why in more detail when we come back, but not just rebel, but rebel in such a way as they would assert something new. An important change in defense of freedom. There was something about them that was special. And part of the reason why they came to be that way was because they were Englishmen. There was something that in the traditions of England that was special. So we haven't yet had a chance to look at that. But now that we've arrived at the end of the colonial wars and we have a British king and an English king, right? I hope you guys are comfortable when I use English and British kind of interchangeably. If you're not, let me know. And so we have this British king who's aspiring to this incredible global empire, and who's going to treat his colonists with increasing disdain as disposable members of the great empire. And then we have Englishmen who won't stand for it and who know enough to make something new. So that's going to be kind of the interesting story to fill in here. Is what did it mean to be an Englishman? Why was that different? There's definitely some anchoring understanding that we need in English history in order to understand. So we'll turn to that, and then that's going to be kind of our last thing that we'll have time for next week. We're going to talk about anchor facts, and we're going to talk about kind of the English background to the American Revolution, and that's going to be the end. We're not going to get into the American Revolution until after the next test. So next week is a test week, test 3. And then when we come back, we will leap into radical changes in thinking that are brought about by the American Revolution. Okay? So, the test is next week, and the new content is the week after. Alrighty? Thank you, everybody. History through art tomorrow. Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye.